Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. What is the matter with U.S. foreign policy in a nutshell?
I think changing our foreign policy from one which is essentially focused on how do we get what we want from the rest of the world. George Kennan in 1948 said we're 6% of the world's population, consuming close to half the world's resources. Post-World War II, how do we keep doing that? How do we get the rest of the nations of the world to allow us to do that? That's gotten us into a lot of trouble. And that's been, I think, the bottom line of what our foreign policy has been.
And what does it look like when people decide they're not going to take it anymore?
During the war with Chechnya, the Russian soldiers were being sent off to fight and kill and die in this far-off part of Russia. And the mothers just were, you know, in tears. They would get word from their sons about how they were suffering in this war, and many of them getting killed. And so they just decided to take matters into their own hands and took the train to the battlefront and took along civilian clothes for their soldiers, went into the military bases, found their children, their sons, and put them into civilian clothes and marched them out of the military base and took them back home.
So I am delighted to have as a guest this week on Talk Nation Radio, David Hartso. David was born in 1941. He has been a peace activist since the 1950s, a conscientious objector, a civil disobedient, arrested over 100 times, from which he has spent less than 6 months in jail. He is a protester who was on the train tracks with Brian Wilson when that train took off Wilson's legs. In 2002, David Hartso co-founded the Nonviolent Peace Force. You can find it at nonviolentpeaceforce.org. He is also the executive director of Peace Workers. You can go to peaceworkersus.org. David Hartso, it's a pleasure to welcome you to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you, David. It's good to be here.
We've discussed the topic of war and peace and how to do away with the former and establish the latter. Give us your basic summary of why in the world you think we still put up with war after all these years.
Well, I think there's a number of parts of it. One is we continue to get propagandized by our government that war is the way to get security. And I think people do want security, but don't realize that by fighting wars all around the world, having military bases in over 140 countries around the world, having drones killing people that we don't like, and along with that many innocent civilians, we're actually becoming ever more insecure. So one is the propaganda. The people, at least, that are running this country like the idea of having an American empire. We're the greatest nation in the world, and we deserve approximately eight times our share of the world's resources. We can intervene in any country we want to. We can overthrow governments. We can, if they elect people we don't like, we can overthrow those governments, etc. And that is making us ever more insecure, because people don't like to be commanded how they should live, and that they need to give up their resources so Americans can live, you know, more luxuriously. I think Senator William Fulbright, back when he was the head of the Foreign Relations Committee during the Vietnam War, and who I got to know in Washington, D.C., wrote a book called The Arrogance of Power. When you have tremendous military power, it goes to your head, and you kind of get the idea that kings of ancient times had, which, you know, other people ought to do things the way you want them to do. And if they don't, you take them out, so to speak. And that's an excellent book that I would encourage people to take a look at. There's also what President Eisenhower warned about, the military-industrial complex. He warned back in 53, I guess it was, the danger of a creeping military-industrial complex that could have influence, unwanted influence on our foreign policy. And since Eisenhower's time, that has increased a thousandfold. Our military budget back at that time was about $40 billion a year. Now it's $100 billion, and if you count money for nuclear weapons and the current wars in Afghanistan, et cetera, and the cost of taking care of the veterans after they come back from these wars, it's more than $1 trillion a year. So there are jobs in almost every congressional district now helping build weapons of war or dependent on military bases. And so congressmen, to get reelected, think, well, we need to vote for these money for, you know, a new generation of nuclear weapons, or for the B-1 bomber or the F-16 fighter jet or more aircraft carriers, and often give even more money than the Pentagon asked for. So we've become economically dependent on this military-industrial complex, which Eisenhower warned about. I think some people are really benefiting by all these wars and by the hundreds of billions of dollars on the military, you know, including all the companies, the corporations, like General Electric and General Dynamics and Boeing, et cetera. They're happy to make the bombers and the helicopters and the napalm. And I mean, that's very good business. And, of course, the American people pay the price. And those corporations, the wealthy in this country, including many of these military companies, in a way have bought our politicians, our political leaders of both major political parties. They have very undue influence on what our policies are. So that's not democracy, when the wealthy and these military corporations actually are making our policy rather than the American people, who are suffering because of all these hundreds of billions of dollars going into war. I had the opportunity to meet with President Kennedy back in 62 in the White House. There were six of us Quakers. And among other things, we were encouraging him to challenge the Russians to a peace race instead of an arms race. And it was very interesting. Kennedy said to us, he was sitting in his rocking chair next to the fireplace, he says, I've been reading The Guns of August, and I'm learning that before the First World War, everyone was arming to the teeth to try to prevent war and to find security. And that was part of what led to that war, was everybody arming to the teeth. And this is back in 62, he says, I'm worried that we could be going down that same track again. And I think this quest for security through more and more armaments is getting us into more and more wars. And, of course, Dick Cheney and George Bush said, well, maybe we'll always have wars. We'll find an enemy. The Cold War is no longer here as a reason to challenge the Soviet Empire. So now we have the war on terrorism, where we're creating more and more terrorists. Every person that we kill with a drone, who is supposedly a terrorist, we probably kill, you know, 5 to 10 innocent people that happen to be in the same house or the building or nearby. And you just think, each of those people has 5 to 10 immediate family members and probably 100 friends and relatives who say, these Americans, they killed my brother, my sister, my mom. I've got to get back at them. So we're creating more and more people that say, we've got to get back at the United States. So it's true, we'll always have wars if we continue this kind of policy.
I think that's an excellent summary of the problem that we're in. I think it was actually just the year before your meeting with Kennedy that Eisenhower, on his way out the door in 61, mentioned the military-industrial complex, because we put a book together around 2011 that called the military-industrial complex at 50.
You're right. It was 61, not 53.
Although 53. Eisenhower understood it in 53. He just didn't say much about it or do much about it until he was on his way out the door. But correct me if I'm wrong, but I wanted to mention to people that there is a wonderful collection of books that should be read on your website at peaceworkersus.org. We are speaking with David Hartso, who is the executive director of peaceworkersus.org and a co-founder of nonviolentpeaceforce.org. And I'm hopeful that those two organizations will come into our continuing discussion, in which I'd like to get to the question of what do we do about it? What are our alternatives?
Well, I think that's a very important question, and I think the American people, if they really understood that there are viable alternatives to this, rat race, arms race, would be very interested in exploring those. I think there are viable alternatives to war and violence as a means to find security and resolve conflict. You know, one of those is negotiation and mediation and diplomacy, where you talk about the differences and try to find solutions that are going to meet the needs of people on both sides. That's what the State Department is supposed to be doing, but too often they're kind of telling other countries what they ought to do, what the United States wants them to do, and what is in American interest rather than what is in the interest of everybody around the world. A second is Gene Sharp, who is probably the greatest historian and theorist of nonviolence, has coined something he calls civilian-based defense, and he's written books called Civilian-Based Defense, and looking at how can a country defend itself using nonviolent means. And the bottom line of what that is you totally non-cooperate with an invading country. The transportation workers refuse to unload the arms. The people in the factories refuse to make products for these people, for the invading country. The soldiers refuse to obey orders to the invaders, etc. And this has actually been tried in a number of countries around the world, and it works.
What are some examples?
Some examples? Well, I mean, you look at Eastern Europe, which was they had communism imposed on them by the Soviet Union. But then in 89, when they found the courage and determination to be free, they just refused any longer to obey the Soviet dictate. Even when the Soviets were threatening to, the security state and the Soviet army refused to intervene. When the people were tearing down the Berlin Wall, when they voted the communist governments out, as in Poland, etc. I happened to be in Moscow right after the attempted coup d'etat in 1991, and literally the most reactionary folks in the Communist Party and the KGB, their FBI, CIA, had taken power from Gorbachev, and 10,000 courageous people went to the White House, their parliament building, where their elected leader was, and surrounded that, and for day and night for 3 days, and when the tanks came to fire on the White House, as they'd been commanded to do, these 10,000 people were offering them food, cigarettes, and water, and said, "You are our brothers and our sisters, and don't shoot." And essentially, they won these folks over. And when the Soviet bombers, bomber pilots, were ordered to come and attack the White House, they came and saw 10,000 people surrounding this building, and they refused to bomb. So even when this military coup commanded millions of troops and had all the nuclear weapons that the Soviet Union had at their disposal, in the face of the Soviet people, the Russian people, refusing to be intimidated, these coup leaders were powerless. Another way of finding security, in my mind, is a giant Marshall Plan, which is what we did after the Second World War, where instead of building military bases all around the world and threatening war with any country that we don't like, if we were to put, say, even a tenth or a quarter of our military budget into building a better life for every person in the world, helping build homes, building medical clinics, expanding the Peace Corps, making it clear that the well-being of every person on Earth is the concern of the American people. I mean, I believe we would be, instead of being afraid, constantly afraid, who's going to attack us next? When's the next 9/11 going to come? We would have friends all over the world. And any government that did not listen to their people that we want to be friends with the United States, would be ousted from office by the people. So this worked, after the Second World War in terms of making people who had been enemies into friends. And I think we have that opportunity again. I think changing our foreign policy from one which is essentially focused on how do we get what we want from the rest of the world. George Kennan in 1948 said something which was very clear. At that time he said, we're 6% of the world's population, consuming close to half the world's resources. The challenge in the post-World War II is going to be how do we keep doing that? How do we get the rest of the nations of the world to allow us to do that? Well, I think that's gotten us into a lot of trouble, and that's been, I think, the bottom line of what our foreign policy has been. It's not how do we build peaceful, just relationships with the rest of the world. It's how do we get the rest of the world to allow us to take their oil, which we call our oil, which happens to be under their soil and under their homes, and how do we get the resources for our computers and for our cars and everything else. So changing that foreign policy to one that is looking at the well-being of every person on the earth, I think would cost a fraction of what the military were spending on the military. It would still be a lot of money, but it would be so much better investment, and it would improve the lives of people everywhere in the world. I think that the American people, in terms of how do we bring about this transformation, need to rise up as we have in the Occupy movement and say this is not acceptable. To be spending $1 trillion a year fighting wars and developing a whole new generation of nuclear weapons and getting ready for the next war, when we are cutting funds for our schools and for our Head Start programs and our food stamps and our aid to universities and higher education, job training programs. We're closing our parks and libraries so we can fight more wars. And the American people need to rise up and say, we're not going to put up with this anymore. We're we're going to non-cooperate. We're going to strike. We're going to refuse to pay our taxes for this war. And half of our taxes, our tax dollars, are going to fight wars and prepare for future wars. When the American people decide that we will not put up with that anymore, it will change. And I think that's what Kennedy, one of the things he actually said to us back in 62, was, if you want me to challenge the Soviets to a peace race and to move away from the military-industrial complex, you're going to have to build a movement that is going to enable me to do that. And that's what we've got to do now. I believe that the churches and the synagogues and all the religious institutions need to take the lead, as they did during the Civil Rights Movement in working with Martin Luther King, to say wars and killing people and is totally unacceptable to everything that we believe in. Close to 90% of people in wars that are killed now are civilians. And what a tragic, horrendous way of trying to resolve conflict. Let's put that money into better lives for the American people and people in other parts of the world. Killing people and doing violence, destroying people's homes and villages and their electrical power systems and their sewer systems, and starving people through economic sanctions has nothing to do. It's the opposite of what we teach in all the world's religions. And why aren't the people that are, you know, in our churches and our synagogues and our communities crying out and saying, let's live like we would like to have other people treat us?
Maybe they've learned too much obedience and not enough civil disobedience. There's so many wonderful examples from this country and around the world of people doing what you're advocating. And one that you've mentioned to me before involved mothers in Russia. I wonder if you could relate that incident.
Yeah, I think that is a powerful example of what should be done. During the war with Chechnya, the Russian soldiers were being sent off to fight and kill and die in this far off part of Russia now, and the mothers who were back in Moscow and St. Petersburg and towns across Russia just were, you know, in tears. They would get word from their sons about how they were suffering in this war, and some of them getting killed, many of them getting killed. And so they just decided to take matters into their own hands and took the train to the battlefront and took along civilian clothes for their soldiers, went into the military bases, found their children, their sons, and put them into civilian clothes and marched them out of the military base and took them back home. Well, this is what mothers all over the world should be doing.
And fathers.
I don't think any mother wants to see their son out on the battlefield killing and getting killed. And there was respect, you know, in Russia, there's respect for women. And you know, so the people that were guarding these bases, they couldn't stop these women. They were quite determined, and they were willing to risk their lives to stop their sons being cannon fodder in somebody else's war.
I think they set an example for the rest of us that should include fathers as well as mothers. Nobody.
I agree. Mothers and fathers.
The attraction, in part, other than finding a job in our distorted economy and so forth, of war for young people for centuries has involved excitement, risk, danger, solidarity, the nobility of making a sacrifice for what you imagine or try to persuade yourself is a good cause. In the 19th century, people like William James sought a moral equivalent of war, something that would provide the good things that war provides to young people without the killing and the death and the suffering. Is there such a course for young people who want to take risks, who want to make sacrifices, who want to work for a better world, to find that sort of outlet in the cause of peace?
Well, I think there is, and there are things, of course, like the U.S. Peace Corps, where people are going out and working in villages, towns around the world. My daughter was in the Peace Corps in Togo, in Africa, working in healthcare. We have started the Nonviolent Peace Force, where we now have hundreds of people from countries all around the world that are going into conflict areas and war zones to try to help protect civilian populations from being the cannon fodder of other people's wars. We have found that in many conflict areas, it's the people that are actually working for peaceful change and people who are human rights defenders who are the people that often are the targets to get killed. And by having international people present with them, that can often not only give them moral support, but help keep them from getting killed. So groups like the Nonviolent Peace Force and Peace Brigades International, Christian Peacemaker Teams, Michigan Peace Teams, to name a few, are recruiting and sending people. Peace Workers actually has a person who's part of a delegation over in Gaza right now. We have people in Jeju Island in South Korea where there's a very courageous nonviolent campaign going on day and night trying to stop construction of a military base, which will destroy their beautiful island, which has some of the most wonderful coral in the world and is an island of peace. And the people there are sitting in front of bulldozers and blocking cement trucks that are destroying their village and their livelihoods. And they're asking for international people to come and be present to try to help nonviolently prevent this. The U.S. is building that military base, the U.S. and South Korean government, as a part of our new policy of surrounding China, containing it, so-called militarily. Well, there's a lot of people whose lives get destroyed. And to see people like this, who actually now 24 hours a day are blocking these cement trucks and the bulldozers and getting beat up by the police and continuing to nonviolently resist is so inspiring.
We need that inspiration, David, but we're going to have to pursue it elsewhere as we're out of time. People can go to nonviolentpeaceforce.org and to peaceworkersus.org to learn more about Jeju Island and locations all over the world. David Hartso, thank you very, very much for being on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you, David. It's a great program you're doing.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. All past shows can be found at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, engineered by Christian Brown in Reno, Nevada, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. Until next time.